You're listening to KPFT in Houston, and with us today we have Douglas Adams, author of his latest work here. We have The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, and if that doesn't ring a bell, you might know him a bit better as the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the three other books in that trilogy of four. And welcome.
Hi. It was the first ever four-book trilogy in the entire history of arithmetic.
I understand. I've been given some pointers as I was talking to people about this upcoming interview that's not necessarily one of your favorite topics right now, The Hitchhiker's Guide. However,
well, it's just that, I mean, it's been 10 years of how did you get the idea for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, and it's funny. I mean, that the particular story about that, I must have told literally thousands of times, and one of the problems you have is when you tell a story that often, after a while, all you can remember is the story. You can't remember the original event because the original event only occurs once. The story occurs, you know, 2,000 times. Which do you remember? You know, so in the end, I mean, I assume the story is true, but I've only got my own word for it.
You know? Have you ever gone back and reread those books in the last couple of years?
No, I mean, there are certain passages I get to read quite often, only because I occasionally sort of stand up and give readings. I don't mean just sort of stand up in the middle of the street. I mean, I get, you know, go. I get invited to do this.
Oh, you know? Okay. Actually been given permission. And I was looking through the bookstore as I was hunting down the other Dirk Gently novel, the first one.
Yeah.
And I noticed that there seems to be a whole lot of companion books to The Hitchhiker's Guide.
Oh, just one, actually. I don't know if the...
Well, there's that. Okay, I just saw the one book, and then there's the computer game. And
oh, that's right, yeah.
And it seems like, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on, and I was wondering, have you got your fingers in all of those pies as well? Are you directly involved, or are they just people doing this?
No, I did... I was very sort of centrally involved with the computer game. You know, took a major part in designing it and writing the text for it and so on. The guide that somebody did, you know, this is a history of Hitchhiker. I mean, I was involved in the guy sort of interviewed me a lot. It did go into all kinds of strange forms because there was the, you know, there was, it started out as radio, then it went to book, then to television. There was the movie incident rather than the movie, if you see what I mean.
Is there footage of the incident? That was going to be my next question, as I heard that there was some talk of a full-length motion picture.
Well, that talk has been going on for 5 years and 6 years now, and, you know, they bought the rights and everything, but basically what happened to the project was Hollywood.
We hate it when that happens.
Yeah, right. And what else? There's even been a bath towel, you know, Hitchhiker's bath towel, which has got sort of woven into it, the towel speech from Hitchhiker, and it's funny. I think I must have got to sign more bath towels than anyone in history. But having said that, I mean, I think one would be hard pushed to find any other one person who'd ever had to sign one towel. So it's not that great a record.
Well, I was Pink Floyd put out a towel for the wall. I don't know if they've had to sign any of their towels or not, but
maybe. But, I don't know.
Well, let's get on to what you're doing lately. I did take time out finally to read Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. And I was wondering if when you wrote that book, if you didn't plan to write anything afterwards because you had so much going on. There was horror and ghosts and aliens and time travel.
Mm. Well, I actually called it a ghost horror detective whodunit time travel romantic musical comedy epic. Largely because I was hoping that people would invent a sort of new category in bookstores, and this would be the only book in it, you know.
I used to
this is the ghost horror detective who done a time travel romantic musical comedy epic section. You
know? There's your book.
That's pretty rich.
And I read it. It was quite fascinating. At least I noticed, like, referring back to The Hitchhiker's Guide, it was good that I did read all four because I thought you weren't going to tie up some loose ends when you did, in fact, get back to. Yeah. Which was refreshing, but I didn't notice that you didn't seem to leave anything open in Dirk Gently's. Yet there's a sequel, and I'm about, let's see, a few pages into this one so far.
Well, it's only a sequel in the sense that Dirk Gently recurs in it, but there's no other sort of plot connection with the previous book at all. I mean, it's totally self-contained, so I mean, it doesn't really matter which one you would read first or anything like that.
Okay, I was also noticing that in the last two books you've really spoken highly of or made it a point to point out that you are using this Apple Macintosh 2 and LaserWriter. And
oh, right, yes. Well, what can I say? I mean, I spend, you know, when I'm at home, I tend to sort of spend sort of 8 or 10 hours a day with this machine, and, you know, it sort of begins to sort of take over your life a bit. One of the things, in fact, there's a mistake here, because the English edition was actually set directly from my own sort of output. And I wrote a note to that effect at the front of the book, and that note also got repeated in the American edition, although it was reset here in America, so the note isn't accurate about that. But I think because they printed so many of them, it'll be the paperback before that's put right. Because now when you write a book, you can actually have, you know, there on the screen in front of you, as you're writing, you've actually got the finished page right in front of you. You print it out on your LaserWriter, and that is actually the finished page, you know, with the sort of the title at the top and the page number and the little sort of line and so on. And there's no real practical benefit to that, except that it's rather sort of, I find it strangely comforting when you get to sort of halfway down page 56 of your manuscript, knowing that you're actually halfway down page 56 of the book, and that's what it'll look like. It kind of gives you confidence in the idea of this actually being a book.
Kind of like in high school when you'd have to like write a paper and then type it and not have nearly as much because you had to have so many pages too.
Right. Yeah.
At least you know how long of an epic that you've written out. Well, that sounds great. I was, you know, trying to think of a different kind of tact in this interview. And one thing was, I thought to ask you is, what kind of question would you ask yourself? What do you think is relevant right now with the Douglas Adams story?
What would I ask myself? When am I next going to get a cup of coffee, I think is.
Okay, well, and that's in short term here, so I think we can arrange for something like that. What about this book? This is what you're out and about doing. You're out promoting this new book. Yeah. And is that something new for you to actually go on a tour like this?
No. I hope it's about to become old for me, actually, because I've done, probably about 10 author tours of the States. And I think I may be sort of getting to the point where I'm not quite certain how many more I want to do. It's funny because your publishers always say, well, it's very, very important for you to do an author tour, you know, because you get to sell more books that way. And it suddenly occurred to me just the other day, but if I don't do the author tours, I might get to write more books that way. So, you know. But in fact, I mean, I'll definitely do one more, because the project I'm working on at the moment is so radically different from anything I've done before that I think it'll be interesting to go out and talk about that. Because I'm doing a kind of wildlife project for radio and a book, which will be called Last Chance to See, and I hope it's not prophetic. Myself and a zoologist friend of mine called Mark Carwardine are travelling around the world, going to various remote locations where we go to look for a number of rare, endangered or exotic animals and make jokes about them. Well, no, not really.
and ridicule them and make fun of their
reading habits. I only say that to wind people up. But when I say we make jokes about them, the point is that the object of the exercise is actually serious, because, I mean, it's something that I'm very concerned about. On the other hand, you know, we're not being sort of po-faced about it. And one of the sort of major ingredients of the whole exercise is that we actually tell it like it is. I mean, everything that happens to us is part of it. So it ends up as sort of being, it's not hushed and reverential. It's more like a cross between Life on Earth and Three Men in a Boat. I mean, to give you an example, I mean, one of the animals we went to look for was the Komodo dragon. Oh, no, I'll take another example. We went to look for the Yangtze River dolphin, which exists in about a 200-kilometer stretch of the Yangtze, and it's an almost blind dolphin, because there's nothing to see in the Yangtze, essentially. You know, visibility is only about 2 inches because of the amount of silt in it. And so the dolphins find their way around just by echolocation, and they communicate with each other just by sound. But they have a real problem, because the Yangtze River is a noisy river. I mean, it is incredibly noisy, because, I mean, it's the main thoroughfare through China, and it's like the Ventura Freeway. It's, you know, it's just chock-a-block with boats with huge, great throbbing diesel engines sort of going up and down it, and it's really noisy in the river. So we decided, we'll see what they have to contend with. We'll try and record underwater. but because we only thought of that when we got there, our sound engineer, you know, hadn't got a waterproof mic, a hydrophone. So he said, well, there is actually a standard BBC technique for recording underwater, for waterproofing your microphone, which is that you insert the microphone into a condom. And as it happened, and none of us had condoms with us in China, you know, it wasn't that kind of a trip.
What kind of message is that? Living our public in a pair.
So there will be one segment of the program which is sort of recounting our adventures on the day we tried to, and eventually succeeded in buying a packet of condoms in Shanghai. And, you know, none of us spoke Chinese, as you might expect, and nobody we found spoke English. So we're having to do a lot of this by sort of mime and sign language and drawing diagrams. So it's just as well it isn't television, you know. Because otherwise, Terry Rakolta, I think, would be getting upset about it. But
so is this going to be like a coffee table type book with pictures and photographs?
Yeah, you'll be able to, you know, sort of balance cups of coffee on it and stuff like that. But it'll be, yes, it'll be sort of probably large format. We haven't finally decided on that, with a lot of pictures, and we hope it'll be entertaining. I mean, the point is, you see, that we want to go for as broad an audience as possible, because largely speaking, books about sort of wildlife and conservation and ecology and so on are only preaching to converted, because those are the people who buy it, you know, the people who are concerned are the people who buy the books. But we would like to get this book out to a lot of people who wouldn't otherwise, you know, buy a wildlife book, because it's going to be, we hope, quite entertaining, and sort of sneak up on them with the serious stuff.
That sounds great. What about short stories? Do you have any other writings in short story format or something like that that might get released? Or?
No, I mean, I've only ever written about two short stories, one of which turns up in the back of the sort of complete Hitchhiker omnibus, which is a rather strange story that I'm not sure it entirely works, to be honest. I belong to an organisation in England called Comic Relief, which is, quite by chance, has got the same name as a similar organisation in England. I mean, it's not that much chance. I mean, it's a fairly obvious name once you think about it. And a couple of years ago, I edited a book in England, which is just a lot of, you know, the best-known comedy writers and so on in England doing stuff. And so I contributed a fair number of things to that, one of which was this Hitchhiker short story, which nobody has understood. And having read it again subsequently, I can see why they couldn't understand it, because I couldn't understand it. And there was also another one in it, which was actually based on a sketch that Graham Chapman and I wrote many, many years ago about Genghis Khan. And I was really quite fond of that. And I was glad to sort of revive, because I don't think anybody ever saw the sketch, but I was quite glad to revive it as a short story. But the only place that's appeared is in this Comic Relief book in England. And that only, in the end, had a large limit, but it was a limited circulation, because I think 500,000 of them were printed. This is all to raise money for Ethiopia and Sudan. 500,000 were printed, and, you know, a huge proportion of that money was going to be going straight through to famine relief. And unfortunately, there were a couple of things in the book that the churches objected to. There was one bit which was the gospel according to a sheep. Now, the point, I mean, I thought this was an extremely sympathetic piece, actually. I thought it was very funny, but it was written by a friend of mine called Richard Curtis, with a few little additions by me. And it basically tells the story of the sort of nativity night from the point of view of one of the sheep that actually gets eaten in the general festivities at the end, and therefore has a slightly jaundiced view of the whole episode. He feels that, you know, this is obviously great for a lot of people, but not so great for himself. And so the churches got very, very upset about that and tried to get us done for criminal blasphemy and sort of picketed bookshops and so on. You know,
well, thank goodness Rushdie came along and took all the pressure off.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a couple of years ago, but I mean, you know, this is raising money for famine relief. I mean, what can you say to that? I mean, it just sort of beggars the mind. I mean, in the end, you know, because the publishers also have the right, which is a very sort of hard won and much protected right, to publish the Bible and all that kind of stuff. It meant that they had to be very sensitive to this, or they were going to lose that. And so they stopped printing the book. And you know, as a result, considerably less money than we could have raised, was raised for famine relief. And but, you know, we have to be careful about people's sensibilities.
Well, certainly. Is there any chance of that finding the light of day again at a later time? Or
I don't know. I doubt it. I doubt it.
Okay, on other things, I was also aware that you did a couple of walk-ins on Monty Python, a couple of Monty Python episodes.
Well, I don't know. Much too much gets made of this, because I am not associated, I have to say, with the Pythons in any way at all, other than, I mean, some of them are mates of mine, but that's it. I mean, they are, I mean, I, the closest connection is that I was a fan of Python when I was at school. You know, these guys are 10 years older than me, and I might say, look it. I did subsequently do a bit of work with Graham at one period when Python wasn't flying. I did, just because I was at a shoot on one occasion, I think I appear briefly on screen, you know, for about 3 seconds. But, I mean, and I think I get a credit on one of the record albums, largely because I was having lunch with them that day. You know, but I mean, that's the limit of the association. And it's funny, I mean, I went because it always turns up in the clippings, you know, Douglas Adams and Monty Python, Douglas Adams and Monty Python. And, you know, I really was trying to sort of tamp this down the whole time. And sometimes I would sort of start interviews saying, look, can we just get something absolutely clear before we go anywhere further, that that I did not write for Python. And the journalists will say, hey, what, Monty Python? And I say, yes, I didn't write for him. They say, what was that like? And I say, I don't know, I didn't do it. Yeah. And then, you know, you read in the paper next week when the article comes out, you know, Douglas Adams, chief script writer for Monty Python, wrote 7 of the episodes and all that kind of thing. What do these guys turn up with a notebook for? You know, what are they writing a shopping list down there?
Yeah. Okay, one other thing, let's go back to the Hitchhiker's Guide. One obscure reference, when Ford Prefect mistook the dominant life form on planet Earth. How obscure did you want to be when you chose the Ford Prefect?
Well, you see, that time, when I was only writing with England in mind, and the Ford Prefect was, you know, a dumpy little family car of the sort of mid to late 50s. I actually saw one the other day in New Zealand. I mean, New Zealand, it's always that you have a problem sort of going to New Zealand, because you, A, cross the international date line, which means that you're going either backwards or forwards one day, but there's also about another 20 years to take into account. So basically, when you cross the international date line at that point, you actually have to adjust your watch by 19 years and 364 days.
Which can be a pain on the wrist.
Yeah.
It was only recently that I found out from Joe here, who works with cars a lot, that the Ford Prefect was in fact an automobile. I knew.
Yeah.
So that was it was kind of something I wanted to get cleared up. In the Dirk Gently novels, do you identify yourself with the character here, Dirk Gently?
I mean, no, not really. In fact, I mean, this is something I'd only say in America, wouldn't say in England. The character of Dirk Gently is actually based absolutely on a friend of mine. And he's a very good friend of mine, and he knows the books very well. He hasn't the remotest idea that this character is him. I even put put the heaviest clue I possibly could in this time, just to see if he'd spot it, because this friend of mine is chronically impecunious, a chronic spendthrift, and a considerable classical musician. And at one point in this book, I actually have, well, Dirk Gently's asleep, and all this stuff is sort of going on the world's waiting for him to wake up, including the delivery of an 18th century dual manual harpsichord that is sort of then collected half an hour later by the bailiffs. and the whole process occurs without even waking him up. And Michael still didn't see it.
This happened to him then. That was right in the beginning. It was pretty amazing. If there was a character in any of your books that you would say might be representative of yourself, is there one who would just...
No, there's not a particular one, but I will often sort of take some little bit of something I think about or worry about or some aspect of me and use that as a sort of keynote in a character. But, I mean, there's nothing that's autobiographical. I suppose, I mean, actually, I mean, the character of Thor in this, who's rather sort of worried the whole time and a bit sort of slow on the uptake, but still... I don't know, that's about it, isn't it?
So, I guess you made your point on the uptake part. So, what is, so you say you're going to have another project that's going to be completely different, so this is just going to be left at two books about Dirk Gently for the time being.
For the time being, this, the Last Chance to See book, I mean, I'm doing, I will be writing it, in, over the summer, then, doing all the tape editing and writing the music for it, which I'm doing, for sort of 3 months, you know, up to about sort of October, November, which is when the program starts going out.
Oh, it's
going to
be a radio series as well.
That's right, yeah. And then I'll sit down to write two new novels. I mean, not both simultaneously. I mean, I'll write one, then the next one. It's usually best to do it that way. And I don't know what they're going to be yet, and I'm deliberately not allowing myself to sort of start fretting about that, because it's nice to have time off from writing novels. You get a bit of sort of perspective on it. I mean, this is... I mean, I've already done the deal to do them. I mean, this is the way that publishing goes these days. I mean, the whole thing, process is started up by your agent has an idea for a contract, you know. So then you have to have the idea for the book. But that actually suits me because, I mean, although I always find, you know, the pressure of deadlines really becomes a sort of nightmare thing, I know absolutely full well without that contract and without the deadline, you know, I'd never get out of bed.
Just like Dirk Gently. What kind of message are you trying to say? I noticed, like I said before, in the first book, you combined a lot of things, and with the horror and the aliens and all of that and the romance. I don't know how complex this one gets. I'm enjoying it as I find out. But what kind of thing are you trying to say with all of that?
I mean, this is... In a way, I'm always reluctant to sort of state baldly what was going on in my mind when I wrote a book, because I hope that whatever it was will sneak up on people from out of the jokes, you know, because essentially, I mean, on the surface level, you know, it's just meant to be humorous and entertaining, and I hope people will, you know, take it on that level, and that anything else in it will sort of bubble up with it, you know, and, but I suppose, one of the major impulses behind it, and this probably will not, you know, if I say what it is, people will say, what? You know, what relation has this got to do with the book? But it was very much in my mind. Was actually to do with the plight of the Red Indians.
Okay.
This came from reading a letter written by a Red Indian chief, Chief Seattle, I think it was about 1850, to the then president of the U.S., whose name I continually forget, in response to the U.S. government's offer to buy Indian land, and you know it was an offer to buy, and if they didn't accept it, you know it's going to be taken anyway. And it's actually an extraordinarily moving ecological statement, apart from anything else. There was a lot of that in my mind when I was writing this book. I think I should sort of give a small prize to anybody who actually spots the connection. But the plight of the Norse gods, mm-hmm. is part of all that. Who are basically now? I mean, they've got all their powers. They just don't know what to do with them, and they're sort of largely living as sort of homeless and derelicts, and sort of hanging around large railway stations in the middle of London.
Is any of this indicating any type of, I noticed, you know, again, say space travel, ghost, paranormal, any of your particular interests showing through in there, maybe in the belief in UFOs or life?
No, I don't have any belief in
UFOs.
Or
the New Age philosophy that seems to be
creeping
up on us?
I mean, Dirk keeps on about this thing that you're never quite certain whether he's being serious about it or not, but in a sense I am, which is, his detection principles, those are the fundamental interconnectedness of all things. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, actually, while I was writing it, I came across a book which actually impressed me profoundly and actually sort of knitted up an awful lot of sort of stray thoughts and observations in my mind, which I don't know if you come across the book called Chaos.
I just saw it at the bookstore over near you.
It's a brilliant, brilliant book. I would heartily recommend it to anybody. In fact, I would say to anybody, the moment you go into your bookstore to buy my book, which you have to do first,
right?
Because this is what I'm here to tell you to do. But also by Chaos by James Glick, which is a revelatory book.
Okay, well, it looks like we need to let you get out of here. So thanks for your time, Douglas Adams.
Thanks,
and
Jane.
hope you enjoy the rest of your stay in Houston. And it's such a wonderful town. You've been listening.
A wonderful day, isn't it?
Yeah, you've been listening to an interview with Douglas Adams on his, well, on many things, including his new book, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul. Recommended reading, of course, here, so check it out, and thank you.